and at precisely 7:30 the following morning, and indeed every morning, by a seagull which perched on our balcony and performed our regular early morning wake-up screech. After breakfast we went to the dive centre, which was about half a mile from the hotel, and met Ian Green. It was Ian who had called the previous evening. He was in charge of all the diving staff on Hayman, and a more helpful and friendly person would be hard to imagine. We got the sub-bug unpacked, and examined it as it stood gleaming in the sun. It is, as I have said, shaped like the front half of a dolphin. The body of it is blue, and towards the front there are two small yellow fins, one on each side, which can rotate through a few degrees and direct the sub-bug upwards or downwards. At the back are two large handles, which you hold onto as the sub-bug pulls you through the water. Within reach of your thumbs are buttons which make the thing go and control its ascent and descent. Inside the bug is a cylinder of compressed air, a normal scuba cylinder, and this provides power to spin the two propellers which push the bug forward, and also supplies air down a flexible tube to a free-floating regulator. A regulator is the thing you stick in your mouth which gives you your air when you're diving. The point of this arrangement is that you only need your mask and flippers. You don't need to carry a scuba tank on your own back, because you're getting your air direct from the sub-bug. The bug is designed in such a way that you can set a maximum depth beyond which it will not go. The very maximum, anyway, is 30 feet. Ian had received a flurry of faxes from Martin Pemberton about setting up the machine and was pretty confident about it. "No worries at all," he said, and asked me what I planned. I said it might be an idea to take it for a shallow local tryout before taking it out into deep water. "No worries," he said. I said that we could then take it with us on the proper diving expedition that was going out from the island the following morning. "No worries," he said. "So I will then spend a little time trying it out, getting used to it and putting it through its paces around the reef." "No worries," he said. "And then," I said, "for the purposes of this article I have to write, which is by way of being a sort of comparative test drive, I want to try the same thing on a manta ray." "No chance," he said. "No chance at all." I suppose I should have foreseen this. Or perhaps it was just as well that I hadn't foreseen it. If I had foreseen it, I wouldn't have been standing there half in a wetsuit looking out at the glittering Tasman Sea and thinking, "Oh, damn." I would have been sitting fiddling in my office in Islington, wondering if I'd done enough work yet to justify going out and getting a bun. The issue was very simple. As someone who has spent over 2 years working on ecological projects, the very first thing I should have realized was that you don't disturb the animals. It might have been all right to try and mount a manta ray 10 years ago when first I heard about it, but not now. No way. You don't touch the reef. You don't take anything. No shells, no coral. You don't touch the fish, except maybe a few that it's okay to feed. And you certainly